Hello, and thank you for joining us for this CMEO snack. From data to decisions, real-world cases in personalized GLP-1 receptor agonist therapy. Today, we may talk about some off-label use of medications, but we'll point that out to you when that's the case. This activity is supported by an independent educational grant from Novo Nordisk. My name is Dr. Amy Rothberg, and I'm a clinical professor of metabolism, endocrinology, and diabetes, and research professor of nutritional sciences at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And I'm delighted to be working with Dr. Jay Shubrick today.
Hi, I'm Jay Shubrick. I'm a professor and primary care diabetologist at Touro University of California, Vallejo, California. I'm delighted to be here.
Our first learning objective today is to understand how to incorporate clinical trial evidence supporting the use of GLP-1 receptor agonists in type 2 diabetes management, including outcomes related to glycemic control, cardiovascular safety, chronic kidney disease, and tolerability. To get us started thinking about clinical evidence and how to apply that to patients in our care, we'll kick this off with a case that we'll return to later. So RB is a 62-year-old woman with type 2 diabetes who has a friend who is taking a GLP-1 receptor agonist and asks if she should be taking one. What information and clinical evidence should you factor into your decision-making for this patient? I'll now turn it over to Jay. Jay?
Thanks, Amy. And boy, that's certainly a scenario that I see quite often clinically. So I'm going to dive into a little bit of the clinical data as it relates to the efficacy of GLP-1 receptor agonists in type 2 diabetes and in other conditions. So we have a wide range of GLP-1 receptor agonists that are available today. And I think if I want to impart anything, it's really important to know that any one of these GLP-1 receptor agonists, as you can see, we have a whole list available, will give you not only a significant hemoglobin A1C reduction on the far right, but that's also associated with weight loss. And really, that was a major change in the treatment of type 2 diabetes, because historically, for about every 1% your A1C dropped, the average person would gain about 6 pounds. And that was quite frustrating for a lot of patients. So now we have agents, because of their ability to affect satiety, and quite honestly, because of their ability to do glucose-dependent insulin secretion, you're going to see these agents lower A1C and contribute to weight loss.
And Jay, I just want to add that there is a lot of heterogeneity in terms of effect. And so while we're looking at mean changes, of course, there are super responders to any one of these drugs. And of course, there are people on the other spectrum, but it's more often than the case that people are responding or super responders.
Yeah, I love that. And I want to just kind of reinforce that if someone has a problem with one of the agents, either not enough efficacy or side effects, that doesn't mean you should lose the entire class, because there is that variability. And I think it certainly, if this is the medicine that you think is right for that patient, it is worthwhile considering a different agent if the first one doesn't get the effect you want or has side effects. So thank you for adding that. And, you know, after the changes that we saw in 2008, where all diabetes-related medicines had to undergo cardiovascular outcome trials to make sure that they were safe and not causing excessive cardiovascular events, lo and behold, to our surprise, at least to my surprise back then, these agents were not only effective in lowering glucose, but they were actually showing evidence of benefit in cardiovascular outcome trials. So before we do anything into the deeper data, I would highlight that none of the GLP-1 receptor agonists have shown any increase in risk of any of the cardiovascular outcomes. So I think that's the first thing I want to take from that. And then if you look across the slide here, across each of the GLP-1 receptor agonists, you are now seeing benefits, not only in glucose lowering and weight, but you can see in REWIND and the LEADER trial and SUSTAIN-6, you're getting advantages in 3-point MACE, meaning major cardiovascular adverse events. In the LEADER trial, you also saw benefits in cardiovascular death. You can see that in rewind and sustain, you had benefits in stroke. And every GLP-1 study that actually looked at kidney outcomes in the cardiovascular outcome trial actually showed benefits in renal events as well. And so this is important because now we're, for the first time, looking at not only a glucose-centric approach, but really a more comprehensive approach to diabetes management from agents that can lower glucose.
So these drugs are really targeting a number of tissues, the origin of many diseases, and so they have pleiotropic benefit besides just glucose lowering in people with type 2 diabetes.
Yeah, and who would have thought? I don't know if you were thinking about this back in 2008, but for me, the idea that these medicines could have these benefits really was quite astounding. And, you know, I was so happy to see it in repeated trials so that we knew this was a real thing. And it was quite exciting.
I agree with you. I mean, this is just an exciting time to be a diabetologist and be able to offer our patients these drugs as therapeutic options for managing a whole host of diseases, both interconnected with diabetes, but even beyond diabetes.
Yeah, and that really highlights the inner and interrelationships between the heart, the kidney, the liver, and metabolism. So when you're hearing more about cardio kidney metabolic, or we can even say cardio liver kidney metabolic, these things are all related and they are amplifiers of each other. So getting something that is having pleiotropic effects is so important. So now let's talk a little bit about the summative data as it relates to GLP-1 receptor agonists. And I want to highlight, we've had GLP-1 receptor agonists for 20 years now. So we have plenty of data as it regards to the safety of this class, as well as the side effects of this class. So if you put all of those listed seven cardiovascular outcome trials together into a single database, even with that heterogeneity of those results, you can see you're still getting a statistical significant benefit in 3-point MACE with a 12% reduction, cardiovascular mortality, 16% reduction, all-cause mortality, 12%, and then, which is even emerging even more now, a renal composite benefit of 17%. And so this is quite important. And while these we're using these agents for the stated condition, maybe of diabetes or obesity, just highlighting the number needed to treat is moderate when you see it's 75 for MACE or 113 for mortality or 62 for renal composite. You're getting benefits far and beyond what your stated indication was. What are your thoughts?
I don't think, Jay, that we've seen a change like this in terms of risk reduction since the class of statins for at least secondary prevention. And we know that they reduced MACE and cardiovascular mortality by about 15 to 18%.
Yeah, 100% agree. It is a game changer. So if we look at the GLP-1s in all of their studies, a meta-analysis of the MACE outcomes in patients with diabetes, but also including patients without diabetes. So they may have had pre-diabetes, or they may have been just been used in a study for obesity. You can see that this meta-analysis favors on the left-hand side the GLP-1 receptor agonist in the great majority of the trials. And in none does it favor placebo because it crosses the midline. So when you put all those things together, you have a net benefit of MACE when you're using a GLP-1 receptor agonist, whether it is for type 2 diabetes or even for those people that have an indication outside of type 2 diabetes. How does this change your practice, Amy?
Well, it's hard to refute this kind of data when you see it displayed like this. And I will tell you that armed with this evidence, I am more inclined, but as you know, I'm already prescribing these drugs for GLP-1 effects on composite renal outcome, both in patients with and without type 2 diabetes.
Yeah. And I think for those of you that may not be using this class as often, really make sure that you're putting in your notes and in potentially even in your SIGs what you're using them for, because you're much more likely to get one of these medicines covered if you're using it for the indication that it is given in the FDA. And so we do have these agents that will have extraglycemic FDA indications. And so it's really a good opportunity for us to get the medicine the patients need. I highlighted earlier that the GLP-1 cardiovascular outcome trials that included renal outcomes all shown benefit. And so now when you put all those studies together, again, those with and without type 2 diabetes, you can see that in many of these trials, there was a benefit favoring GLP-1, favoring to the left. None of the trials actually favored placebo. And the net benefit was that the composite renal outcome was better if the patient was on the GLP-1 receptor agonist. And again, this is, again, so important. And I think you're going to see more and more studies that come out showing that we should think of these agents not only as a diabetes drug or an obesity drug, but maybe it's also a kidney drug.
I think it is, Jay. It is a kidney drug and all the other indications that you so eloquently discussed.
Yeah, thank you. And I want to highlight, as I think about my patient with diabetes, often a decline in renal function becomes a decision point for stopping other medications, for example, sulfonylureas, metformin, SGLT2 inhibitors. We know that we can continue to use the GLP-1 receptor agonist even with lower levels of eGFRs. And with the exception of two of the GLP-1s, exenatide and lixisenatide, that are renally excreted, the rest of them you can continue to use across all stages of kidney disease. And we know that even with those advanced patients with advanced kidney disease, weight loss is critically important. So I will still use these agents throughout the spectrum of the condition.
And I just want to remind the audience that GLP-1s don't lose potency with declining GFR.
Really important point. So one of the emerging things that I think is so important to talk about is the association of obesity and type 2 diabetes to MASLD and MASH. And for many people, this may be a new term for you. MASLD is metabolic-associated steatotic liver disease, and MASH is metabolic-associated steatohepatitis. Those used to be called NAFLD and NASH, and it is present in 30% of the world's population and more than 70% of people with type 2 diabetes. So it's something that we really should be thinking about.
So MASH, formerly known as NASH, really parallel the rise in rates of obesity. And despite the limitations of some epidemiologic studies to diagnose these conditions, MASLD indeed is one of the most common of all liver diseases in the US, if not globally.
So it's so important to recognize that we're seeing new indications and new benefits for these agents. So the last one I'll highlight is that there has been a recent FDA indication study showing that even in obstructive sleep apnea, the GLP-1s have been or dual incretins have been beneficial. So tirzepatide was involved in studies for moderate to severe obstructive sleep apnea and actually showed an improvement in those patients, both with BiPAP and those without BiPAP. And we're going to have some cases coming up where we can talk about these extraglycemic indications. But there's just been so much data out there, and we're seeing that the body is interconnected, and there is real value in trying to find a weight-associated treatment that can give benefit across the spectrum. So let's talk a little bit about the clinical data as it relates to safety of GLP-1 receptor agonists in type 2 diabetes and other conditions. The GLP-1 receptor agonists have multiple different benefits, but they do have some important adverse events and side effects that should be discussed with our patients. Most common side effects are related to the GI tract. Remember that these agents slow down GI emptying and increase satiety. So it's important for us to recognize that now that we're rebooting our system's ability to feel hungry and to feel full, that we have to kind of eat accordingly. So I think it's important to recognize that some people can feel nauseousness. On less occasions, sometimes people can have vomiting or diarrhea and even constipation. I think it's important to recognize that when we're using these agents, we want people to moderate their eating. Please eat more slowly. consider eating half your plate and waiting 15 minutes before you eat the other half of your food, and make sure that you're being moderate in your eating. If these side effects are more than just transient, please reach out to us and let us know. And if you find that they are not reducing in severity, that would be a time to reach out. But, you know, quite honestly, when I'm sharing this with my patients, often they are surprised that they have less side effects than I initially mentioned. So I think prepping the patient really makes a big difference in terms of being prepared. And I mentioned earlier that we've had more than 20 years of safety with these agents. And so now that we have them, we can take that meta-analysis of all of these agents and look at the potential serious adverse events or risks. And so you had mentioned earlier, Amy, about medullary thyroid cancer. We know that that is something that occurs in non-primate rodents. And so we have found that in the meta-analysis of all the CVOTs, there haven't even been enough thyroid cancers to do any evaluation. When we look at pancreatitis, while this is an idiosyncratic reaction to very few patients who take GLP-1s or DPP-4s, there was no statistical significant increase risk in pancreatitis. And while there was a numerical decrease, there was no significant difference, even in pancreatic cancer. Yes, type 2 diabetes alone increases your risk of pancreatic cancer, no increased risk with these agents. And there has been a signal as it relates to retinopathy, but at least in the meta-analysis, there was no increase in retinopathy in patients who were put on a GLP-1 receptor agonist, albeit there is still some warning as it relates to that, and maybe even a new potential signal. Amy, what side effects and what safety things do you talk to about with your patients when you start a GLP-1?
Thanks, Jay. I discussed some of the same side effect profile that you discussed. I also want to make the point that because these drugs suppress hunger, and we often confuse thirst for hunger, they also have a tendency to drink less volume or fewer liquids. And so I do make a point or strongly encourage my patients to make sure that they're drinking an adequate amount of water, particularly in the scenario where they may have a little bit of nausea, vomiting, and that may incur some dehydration, and then the rare risk of a course of acute kidney injury. There also, I'm very careful to ask about underlying anxiety or depression that may not be well controlled. Enhanced anxiety or depression is likely to be transient in nature if it occurs at all, and in fact may be unrelated to the drug. It may be we're causing a little bit of concern by just raising the issue, and so people are more attuned to their mood when they just first start taking a GLP-1, but I provide that caution nevertheless.
Really important points. And again, I think letting the patient be prepared ahead of time to know what to expect really will allow them to help navigate and control any potential side effect and be successful. So I'm going to turn it over to you for the next learning objective.
Okay. Well, our next learning objective is trying to understand how we utilize current treatment guidelines to implement GLP-1 receptor agonist therapy that should be tailored to the unique patient characteristics, including comorbidities, our goals of care for them, and lifestyle considerations. Well, just as a refresher, here's a table listing the current FDA indications for the respective GLP-1 receptor agonists. Let's be clear that all of the GLP-1 receptor agonists have the FDA indication for type 2 diabetes. And then it's more variable in terms of management of adolescents with obesity and management of those with underlying cardiovascular disease or who have risk factors for cardiovascular disease. But I'll leave that to the individual to review.
So I think now that we have kind of reminded everyone of the FDA indications of these agents, let's see if we can apply what we've learned today to some cases. So MV is a 51-year-old female who presents because she has an inability to lose weight. She is a first generation Indian. She's married and works as a physician in a private practice. She is a self-described foodie and enjoys traveling for the food experience, and actually has given us already some great advice about places to go this weekend. She doesn't smoke, and she does drink a glass of wine with dinner on some nights, but not all nights. But she has a strong family history of type 2 diabetes, both in both parents and even in some of her siblings. Now, her medical history is significant for type 2 diabetes with a current A1C of 8.1%. She does have hypertension, and she does have mixed dyslipidemia. She's not aware of any diabetes focused complication. And if you looked at her, at least her initial vitals, her blood pressure is well controlled at 112 over 68, and heart rate is 80 beats per minute. So let's take a look at our patient's meds. So she's currently taking basal insulin glargine, 30 units a bedtime. She takes mealtime insulin aspart, 5 to 6 units as a fixed dose at meals. She is taking pioglitazone 30 milligrams once daily, losartan 50 milligrams daily, amlodipine 2.5 milligrams daily, and atorvastatin 40 milligrams daily. She has tried metformin, including metformin ER, multiple times, and it really has not been able to tolerate anything more than 500 milligrams because of GI side effects, and really does not have any particular interest in restarting metformin. So, Amy, as you think about this patient and kind of her background, her meds, and her goals, what are your initial steps?
Jay, this is a person that I think we're all too familiar with, somebody who comes in with suboptimal glycemic control on insulin and maybe one or two other oral agents, also has hypertension being treated for dyslipidemia, and further has been intolerant to metformin due to its GI side effects. By the way, that is not a reason for which not to use a GLP-1. If one is intolerant to metformin, that does not mean they will be intolerant to a GLP-1. I think the goal would to be improve her glycemia and improve her other comorbid conditions by also helping her lose weight and targeting those respective tissues. And to reduce the amount of insulin she's on, or even perhaps eliminate insulin, because as we know, insulin potentiates weight gain, and it certainly makes it harder to lose weight, which is really one of our goals. So let's just turn to and review some of the guidelines or evidence.
Yeah, I think you've brought up so many important points. So this is someone who is working hard. I would first give them congratulations for managing a complex regimen and actually achieving some, success, let's say, particularly for hypertension. This is someone who we want to help her lose weight. And we have agents on board that are fine agents for lowering glucose, but have been associated with weight gain. So one of the first things I might do is think about what can I remove? Right? Which are the agents that are going to be contributing to weight gain that I could, such as pioglitazone, such as insulin, and how can I help her to achieve even better glucose control, maybe with a simplified regimen? Right? So it's very common for me to, when I start a GLP-1, if this is the right decision for this patient, to easily get rid of mealtime insulin, particularly at that low dose. I mean, that's a relatively low dose of mealtime insulin. And over time, I'll be able to certainly look at getting rid of potentially pioglitazone, as well as maybe even reducing mealtime insulin. And those in itself will have some benefit. But I do think it's important to highlight that, she does talk about being a foodie, and there's nothing wrong with being a foodie, but also talking about the things that she can particularly do, because it sounds like she's well versed as a physician. Making sure that she's contributing to her success as well.
And I just want to add, I mean, she is coming, as you said, to discuss her inability to lose weight. How refreshing that a patient is coming to discuss their weight. So often we're discussing all the sort of comorbid conditions associated with weight, and then bringing up weight sort of secondarily, whereas she's making this primary encouraged to her because there is so much stigma associated with discussing weight. We know that people with overweight and obesity are stigmatized. There is a lot of bias against them, and not just from, society, but from healthcare providers.
Yeah, and no matter who this patient is, this is a great opportunity for us to be an ally with them, to give them resources and information to help them achieve their goals.
And to be their cheerleader. So why don't we
Absolutely.
turn and talk about guideline recommendations for GLP-1 receptor agonists in people with diabetes and comorbid health conditions? For one thing, when we're talking about diabetes, we do need to individualize glycemic targets. And while most individuals, the target probably of 6.5% is achievable and safe, there are other reasons where that may need to be more generous. For example, for older people with multiple comorbidities, frailty, or a limited life expectancy. And there's also guidelines about what to start and how many agents to start, depending upon the baseline hemoglobin A1C. And I'll leave that for the audience to review. But let's just look at the table before us. And you can see at the top are sort of categories of things that we need to consider when prescribing certain agents. For example, do they have overweight or obesity? Are they at risk for hypoglycemia? What about access and cost? And on the other end of the spectrum, do they have severe hyperglycemia? So let's review some of the preferred agents under all these categories. For example, if they have overweight or obesity, we should consider a GLP-1 receptor agonist or GIP/GLP-1 receptor agonist, or even an SGLT2 inhibitor. An alternative might be, if they're not able to tolerate or if accessibility is a problem, a DPP-4 inhibitor, which is weight neutral, or a TZD. What is not preferred is a sulfonylurea or a glinide. And the reason for which these are not preferred is because they can potentiate again weight gain. And this is counterproductive, particularly for those with overweight and obesity or obesity and have other cardiometabolic kidney risks. Let's address hypoglycemia now. Obviously, a preferred agent because they work in a glucose dependent fashion and don't really lower glucose into an abnormal range in the absence of insulin secretagogues or insulin are the GLP-1 receptor agonists or GIP/GLP-1s, or alternatively, the SGLT2 inhibitors. Alternatives to the preferred class are once again DPP-4 inhibitors or TZDs. And again, just like I said before, for the category of overweight and obesity, we should try to avoid sulfonylureas and glinides because they do enhance hypoglycemic risk. Let's talk about accessibility, availability, and cost. The preferred agents given cost are TZDs, sulfonylureas, and glinides. Alternatives could be insulin or DPP-4 inhibitors, the ones that are, of course, generic. What are not preferred based upon cost and previously availability, but this seems to be less so a problem, are the GLP-1 receptor agonists, GIP/GLP-1 receptor agonists, and SGLT2 inhibitors, along with some other drugs. Let's address severe hyperglycemia. In individuals with severe hyperglycemia, we really need to consider insulin, both basal and prandial insulin, particularly when we want to more safely and rapidly improve glycemia to avoid continued gluco and lipotoxicity. But we can also and should consider GLP-1 receptor agonists or GIP/GLP-1 receptor agonists, Alternatively, we could consider basal insulin on top of other oral agents. But what we should try to avoid are other agents likely ineffective in the setting of glucose toxicity, and those are many of the oral drugs that we are commonly using. Jay, anything you would add?
Boy, thank you for that comprehensive review. And I think we know so much about these medicines now that it is important to recognize where's the niche where they go quite well. And having guidelines that really call out the need for one, potency of glucose lowering, two, weight reduction, and then three, important comorbidities really makes this, while it sounds complicated, quite a bit easier. And I actually will commonly have a chart like this in my office. So my patients can actually say, and they will look at something like this and say, well, wait a minute, I'm interested in weight loss. Could I consider this medication? Or I've been having lows. Is this is my current medication a cause of that? And so I think you can actually take this quite detailed data and make it into a good shared decision-making opportunity for our patients.
Thanks, Jay. So let's turn and talk about guideline recommendations for GLP-1 receptor agonists in type 2 diabetes and individuals with other comorbid health conditions. And just like you may have a chart like the preceding slide, I often have a chart like this in my office, sort of highlighting the considerations around the particulars of a certain GLP-1 receptor agonist. So, independent of glycemia targets and other type 2 diabetes therapies, we can consider GLP-1 receptor agonists or SGLT2 inhibitors when confronted with individuals who have atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease or high risk for ASCVD. Of course, for those who have heart failure, I think we need to think about SGLT2 inhibitors in individuals at risk for stroke or had a stroke or TIA. And let's remember, TIA is not a benign condition. Again, GLP-1 receptor agonists or pioglitazone. And then with chronic kidney disease, of course, SGLT2 inhibitors or GLP-1 receptor agonists, or commonly the combination of both. So let me just sort of recapitulate what I showed in the table. For those who have or at established cardiovascular disease or who are at high risk for atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, who have albuminuria, proteinuria, hypertension, left ventricular hypertrophy, LV systolic or diastolic dysfunction, or an ABI of less than 0.9, please consider a GLP-1. For those with atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease and stroke or who've had a TIA, we should consider dulaglutide, liraglutide, and semaglutide. And for those with chronic kidney disease, we need to consider a GLP-1 receptor agonist with those benefits. Semaglutide at this time is the only GLP-1 receptor agonist currently approved to reduce the risk of eGFR decline and end-stage renal disease in cardiovascular-related death in adults with type 2 diabetes and chronic kidney disease.
Yeah, and what a wonderful discussion. And I think it's so important when we're considering these agents that the guidelines support using them as first line if there's a compelling comorbidity, or making sure you make room for those agents for those patients who have diabetes and have that comorbidity. So making sure you're taking other medicines without the pleiotropic benefits, maybe potentially reducing them or taking them off. And so while it may mean switching therapies, it often will end up simplifying therapies.
Let's talk about patient case RB. She's a 62-year-old woman with type 2 diabetes and a body mass index of 36 kilograms per meter squared, who has a friend who's taking a GLP-1 receptor agonist and asks if she should be taking one. She works as a graduate school librarian, has never smoked, drinks one glass of wine per week, endorses no drug use. She's single, is without children. She Mentions that she has an elliptical at home, but she's not using it. Her other medical problems include hypertension mixed dyslipidemia, and she's actually undergone sleeve gastrectomy. This was complicated by gallstone pancreatitis, for which she underwent cholecystectomy. As you can see, her blood pressure is adequately controlled. Her heart rate is 72. However, her creatinine is elevated at 1.6 milligrams per deciliter, and she has a slightly elevated urine albumin to creatinine ratio. Her A1C is 7%. And as you can see graphically, what has occurred with her weight over time? Let's just go back where she was 250 pounds. And then even gained weight, at which time she underwent sleeve gastrectomy. And you can see over the course of 2 years, she lost nearly 100 pounds. However, there was gradual recurrent weight gain over a very long period of time, that is 5 years. And I will say, having known this individual, she did get busy with lifestyle intervention and lost a considerable amount of weight. But then again, over the course of time, gradually had recurrent weight gain. Her current medication profile consists of lisinopril, metoprolol, atorvastatin, metformin a gram twice daily, and sitagliptin 100 milligrams once daily. And she's taking adequate vitamin D and calcium citrate daily. So I have a few questions. Can we stop or replace metoprolol? Does she need sitagliptin? Can you replace with an alternative such as a GLP-1 receptor agonist? Does she need a DEXA? And does she need lifestyle counseling?
Boy, these are just really great questions from a very rich case, and thank you so much for sharing that. So I think the first thing I would really want to do is make sure that we have a sense of what her daily routine looks like now. She's on a lot of different medications, and I'd really like to know, is she able to keep up with that regimen? And I often ask patients not how are they taking medicines, but I ask how often they're missing the medication. Because I think it gives them the freedom to say, well, you know, actually, I can't actually get them all in. So I do think that that would be one of the first things I do. As I think about it, you know, you're going to have to decide your hemoglobin A1C goal for this patient. She's 62. She does have some complexity to her own, her history. So you might choose a 7%, or you might choose a more relaxed goal for this patient. That being said, I think that she's had an ongoing journey with trying to lose weight. And I do think that's something it sounds like is important to her. And so I do think we should look at that. Medicines like sitagliptin often are renally dosed. We actually probably don't think that's much related to safety. But in addition to her creatinine, I might want to know her eGFR. And she does have at least some stage of kidney disease with a, you know, G stage, my guess is either 3A or 3B. And she's got an A2. Albuminuria. So I want to take that as something else that I should be addressing. Her blood pressure is very well controlled. And, you know, we could talk about whether metoprolol is contributing to fatigue or getting in the way of her goals. But I do think this is an opportunity to say, how can we simplify her treatment? How can we help her match her treatment where she's at today with her ongoing comorbidities? And then absolutely, it's always a great time for lifestyle intervention and re-educating when there's major changes in life. So I'll bounce some of these questions back to you, Amy, but I also want to know, are you worried about using a GLP-1 in this patient who had a history of pancreatitis?
Well, her pancreatitis was related to gallstones, so I am not worried about recurrent pancreatitis in this setting. I would say that I th think that we, for other reasons, metoprolol in her setting is really being used for hypertension and not for underlying cardiovascular disease. And there are certainly other options for managing her blood pressure. And so, if at any possibility of sort of replacing metoprolol, I probably would, because as you said, it may be contributing to fatigue. And also, because of reduced thermogenesis, maybe again making her more predisposed to weight gain or certainly weight resistance. I would say we could get a DEXA for bones, but she's 62 years old. And so also the payer is unlikely to pay for that given she is not at the screening age of 65. So I think a GLP-1 would be appropriate if we were to consider a GLP-1 receptor agonist in her case. Clearly, we should probably discontinue sitagliptin. I don't think that, in fact, is probably doing much at this point for her glycemia anyway. And she does have diabetes and, as you said, sort of a lower GFR or chronic kidney disease, in which a GLP-1 receptor agonist would be appropriate. Everybody, I think, with very few exceptions, should have lifestyle counseling. That is still paramount to many of the comorbid conditions we are treating. And so I would be referring her to a program or a good dietitian and to have sort of frequent interaction. We know so many times that lifestyle sort of gets a bad name, but it's only because there is infrequent encounters and longitudinal follow-up. I want to add that there have been a number of meta-analyses of RCTs and cohort studies looking at GLP-1 use post-bariatric surgery and has shown that for those who have had recurrent weight gain, these are highly effective drugs from an additional weight loss of anywhere from about 4.5 kilograms to as much as 8 kilograms in weight loss. When they have had recurrent weight gain following bariatric surgery. And we know from seminal trial of a combination of RCTs of bariatric surgery for type 2 diabetes that GLP-1 use was actually widely used at 7 years and almost 30% of the population was using GLP-1 receptor agonists for either sort of diabetes relapse after remission or for recurrent weight gain at 12 years.
These are really important data that you've shared. And I think, again, I agree. Not only is this use of a GLP-1 safe for this patient, but it would be actually guideline directed because of her kidneys that we really should consider to make space for a GLP-1 receptor agonist and an SGLT2 inhibitor for this person if there's residual proteinuria. And so I do think you don't need to use a GLP-1 and a DPP-4 inhibitors together. So you would definitely get rid of that DPP-4 inhibitor. But I think those are agents that are going to help that patient with her weight journey, will probably help her with her blood pressure, and will be guideline-directed therapy.
Thanks, Jay. So let's summarize with our SMART goals. They are specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely. That is what we hope that our audience will take from this presentation to apply to your practice. Let's base more prescribing decisions on individualizing therapy. We need to address patients with the goal of reducing complications of type 2 diabetes by focusing on integrated metabolic improvements, reduced microvascular complications. First and foremost, we need to consider quality of life outcomes. Those patient-reported outcomes are critical. And then comprehensive, of course, cardiometabolic risk reduction. You can find more information for you and your patients by visiting the Metabolic Disease Hub. Please watch the other programs in this series and don't forget to register for a live Q&A with Jay and me on November 13th, 2025 at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. When you register, you can submit questions for us to answer. If you watch the entire series, not only can you get continuing education credit, but you can claim a badge as a patient-first diabetes management champion. Don't forget to take the post-test and evaluation to claim your CME or CE credit. Please do that. We want to thank CME Outfitters for helping us make this program possible, and we thank you so much for participating.